All right, today's message is specifically created, you'll be interested to know, with Beloit in mind. You're hearing it for the first time ever. It's for you. Although it might be well suited for Chicago and Northwest Indiana, but today the message is on the value of our older members. The average age of the Beloit congregation is 67 years of age. That should not be a surprise. And if you remove the three younger ones that are in our midst right now, I'd include you, Ian, but three of the younger ones, the average age goes up to 73. So 73 is the average age of a congregation. If you take out the three youngest ones, or otherwise it's 67. For that reason, in thinking about what would be a message that would be helpful to this congregation, the value of our older members came to mind. In fact, the title is very straightforward: the high value of our older members, that being most of you. So the purpose of the message is to provide encouragement of how God has appreciated those who are older, and how he used them. And the approach for the message, just so you kind of know how we're going to structure this or how we're going to go forward, is the first, I'm going to provide examples of those who were extremely effective servants of God in their older age. So there's quite a few. In fact, I might say that they were the most effective when they're older in most cases. Second, we will look specifically at how older members provide value to the church, the congregation. So that's how we're going to approach it. So for those who are older, there are some scriptures that I'm sure you can relate to very well. So those that are older, most of us in this room, except for the young men, there's still the young men that, I'll take the young man. You'll laugh at him and have an interesting thing I'll share with you in a moment here. The scriptures speak how quickly time flies by, and many of you in this room, it seems just like yesterday that you were graduating from high school or getting married or getting your first job or whatever it might be. It seems like people always say it seems like just it was just yesterday. And most older people, they feel young in many ways. They still think in their minds that they're 18 years old. Then they catch a glimpse of themselves in the mirror, and then there's that double look. Is that really me? Or maybe you try to get up out of the chair fast, and that's not so easy. In fact, I'm experiencing that myself. The young man, as I was called. I look at myself in the mirror, and for a moment, I'm like, my dad's here. And then I'm like, no, he's not here. That's me. Here's another interesting thing you'll find, I think, amusing. When I first started pastoring Munster, a member who who doesn't mind sharing things with me, the member came up to me and he commented to me, "I see you robbed a cradle." And I'm like, looking at him like, his meaning was, oh, you must have been much older than Joanna when we married. You know, married someone much younger. And I think he might have been surprised. Either I look very, very old, but I will say might have been surprised to find out Joanna and I are exactly the same age, maybe 3 months apart. But she's obviously aging. I can tell by your action. She is aging much. She is great. She is aging much more gracefully than I. Much more gracefully than I. Yes, we are the same age. So I figured I look very, very old, or she looks her age, or maybe a little bit of both. She looks much younger for her age, and maybe I'm just looking a little older for my age. Who knows? But I thought that was funny. I go, just because we're exactly the same age. We're actually trending more towards 60 these days. So if you ever want to know how old I am, and Joanna and I are, we're certainly closer to 60 than 50. So that's probably still a young man, though, right here, in this age, in this group, still a young man in this congregation. But for those who are even older, they can look at the scriptures and say just how true these scriptures I'm about to read to you are. They can relate to it. In James 4:13, if you want to turn there, James 4:13. James 4:13. James writes, and you'll know the scripture, and he's kind of making a point here, but he has one little thing in there that I want to point to. James 4:13, James writes, "Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow, we will go to such and such a city, spend a year there, buy and sell, and make a profit, whereas you do not know what will happen tomorrow. For what is your life?" He says, that's the question, what is your life? "It is even a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanishes away." And he goes on to say, instead, you ought to say, "If the Lord wills, we shall live and do this or that." So James is expressing what many share, understand, that life, especially in this room, life is a vapor. It seems just like yesterday, as I mentioned, you're buying your first car. You're starting a new job, graduating from high school, all that. And life, that just seems like yesterday. And yet, look where we are. Many of you are like, look where I'm at. What happened? Life is a vapor, just kind of happens. Yet, you know, it is just a vapor, as James says, but there's also a purpose for that time that God does give us that leads to eternity. So even though this life seems like a vapor, ultimately, there's a purpose for it and does ultimately go forever, eternity. Ephesians 5:16, you don't have to turn there, Ephesians 5:16, but there's a comment that Paul puts in here, says, redeeming the time because the days are evil, redeeming the time because the days are evil. Because time for us in the flesh is always moving, and we only have so much of it. Paul says, redeem the time, buy back whatever time we have, making the most of the time we have, making the best use of our time. You know, I met a lady one time at the feast. This happened to be in, I believe, Pewaukee, not too long ago. I think a couple of feasts ago. And her husband, you know, she was older, and her husband was older. Her husband was in her 80s. And she said, she told me, he gets up every day at 5 a.m. to study the Bible and to learn as much as he can because he knows his time is limited. And he was just so interested in learning as much as he could while whatever time he had. And he was so enthusiastic to get up and do that. And in his 80s, he was redeeming back the time that he had. And that example always stayed with me. This person who's in their 80s realizing there's so much more he still needed to understand and know and grow in. And he was getting up at 5 a.m. to study the Bible and just put his mind to studying God's word. And I thought that was a very impressive comment, and that he would do that. But it was like what Paul said, redeeming the time, buying back. There's only so much. And where he was in life, he realized there's not that much time left. And that's what he was choosing to do, redeeming the time, buying back, using the best way he can. Time goes by, and what can we learn from those that are older? To redeem the time, and those who are older, from what I can see, like the men mentioned, are redeeming back the time, making the best use of their time. So let's look at some examples of those that are older in the Bible and how God was able to use their maturity in a very effective ways. Let's look at Paul. Let's look at Paul, start off with there. And let's turn to, I know somebody's, at least somebody I believe enjoys this book, Philemon. Philemon 9, verse 9. If you want to turn to Philemon 9, I believe that's right next to Hebrews, if I remember right. Before Hebrews, Philemon 9. And here's Paul writing. And we know a little about this. We heard about it a little bit earlier, not too long ago. But he says, "Therefore, though I might be very bold in Christ to command you what is fitting, yet for love's sake, I'd rather appeal to you, being such a one as Paul the aged, and now also a prisoner of Jesus Christ." So here Paul is making a plea to Philemon. Now Paul doesn't directly make mention of his authority in the office as an apostle. He was an apostle, But it's understood that Paul could have selected that. He could have gone down that way. I'm an apostle, and I'm telling you. He hints at that by saying he's able to be bold in Christ to command something. But he doesn't really take that. He mentions it, but he's not going to take that tact. It's a very well-written letter. The experienced, older, and wiser leaders, this is my observation, wiser leaders are less likely to use their office or authority as the final option with members to consider a better approach or path. You know, that's what I've noticed. Older, the much older ones don't tend to do that. Paul says, he referenced himself as age. He's referenced his age. And the situation is a gentle way to ask Philemon to consider his request on behalf of Onesimus. Now, there's a man, I don't know if you know him, you might know him, Mr. Pickett. He since died. He was a deacon in our church. He died in his 90s. And I can think of Mr. Pickett, and he was a 90-year-old, in his 90s. And he was a deacon and very active up until the very end. And I can think of him, you know, Mr. Pickett. And if he had a preference on, we all tried to consider it and show honor to his age and the culmination of his life experiences. He was in the Air Force and was in and flying over and don't remember exactly the airplane he flew on, but he had quite an experience in flying and had done a lot. But it was a way to show honor. He was like the deacon, and we were all like, okay, if that's how you want to do it, we'll do it. And he'd have to, you know, because of his age. It's like Paul saying, because I'm Paul the aged, and Mr. Pickett didn't say, you know, I'm Mr. Pickett the aged, but he didn't have to. He just, okay, if that's the way he wants to prefer something, we'll do it that way, just because of who his years have been. And that's what Paul is sort of doing here. Paul calls himself the aged. We're not sure how old he is, but if you read the letter of Philemon, which Mr. Christensen did not too long ago, which I really appreciate it, that letter is masterfully written by someone who has the wisdom of someone older, mature, and could make appeals in a diplomatic way, very diplomatic, really written. In fact, the term old man or aged man in Greek can also apply to being an ambassador. If you look up the Greek word, it says old man, or it even has a reference to being an ambassador. And you think about that, you know, ambassadors, if governments typically send out 20-year-olds to be ambassadors. No, they don't. They don't do that. Why would they? That'd be because the, you know, younger men, who knows, they might give, you know, if you put the older men as ambassadors for your country, because they've got to send something, they've got to say something very diplomatically. They've got to present something maybe that's very delicate. And you don't want to start a war over something that's not pronounced or said the correct way. So ambassadors and old men, it's kind of a similar, it's the same word, or it's a word that can be applied to ambassadors, and the translators translated for what was meant, an older man or aged man, but it also can refer to, if you look it up, ambassadors, and that's because it's, you know, think about it, ambassadors have to be diplomatic, and they have sensitive things they say, and just like Paul, he's an older man, he's saying something in a very delicate situation, he's saying it in a masterful way that only he could do, and at his age and maturity. Let's go back to Paul's earlier life, Acts 7:58, when he is actually a young man, as they refer to him, young man, Acts 7:58. So Acts 7:58, and this is when they just had stoned Stephen. And it says, they cast him out of the city and stoned him, that being Stephen. And the witnesses laid down their clothes at the feet of a young man named Saul. So we know, based on knowing Saul's life, we know that at this point, he was not a diplomatic at his younger age, especially without God's spirit. He wreaked havoc. There's problems. Whenever Paul was around, there was not a lot of diplomacy, let's put it that way. We don't We also don't realize, many times you don't think about this, we don't realize how much time went by from his conversion, this happened soon after this, and when Paul was denounced to be an apostle. Sometimes you think, oh, he was converted on the way to Damascus, and he went out and started being an apostle. Well, he actually wasn't. He was, a lot of time went by before he actually went out on his missionary, missions. He was a lot of time. He was quite a bit older. You can do a study into that. Galatians gives you some hints because he goes about 14 years. He says about he went back and he tells a little of the story. Acts only gives you little threads of information and history, and you have to put other things together. And if you do that with Galatians, you find out that there was some decent amount of time went by before Paul, from his conversion, went out and became an apostle and did what he was asked to do by Christ. The Holy Spirit certainly was working in Paul, but he was also maturing as he aged. He matured. So I think growing older in years and the Holy Spirit working in someone cannot really be separated when looking at spiritual maturity. For some of the older ministry, I think about some of the older ministry, I really appreciate being able to have heard them when they were younger. You hear some of the younger ones when they were younger, and hearing them when they're much older. I can think of my dad, of course, and his style when he was speaking over 50 years ago, very different than he is today. This feast we had a man, you would probably know, Mr. Antion, at the feast, and he is in his 81st year, I believe, over 80 years old. And his style is quite different than when he was a teacher that I had when I was 18 years of age. At 18 years of age, I went to Ambassador College, and he was one of the instructors, and I had him as a teacher. And he's very, he's different style than he was then. And I was commenting that at the feast, that the styles change over the years, and often the more energetic and speaking style, maybe, banging, we don't have much of that anymore, banging or whatever it might be, or whatever people do when they're younger, it's been replaced with a more mature way of preaching that's very, very effective. At least I find it very effective to hear some of the older, I'm talking about much older, Mr. Antion is 80. My dad's just a month or so from being 80. And you had some of these people that we're still very blessed to have with us that are very able to speak. And I just appreciate hearing how they were then. It was very effective, and hearing how they are now. It's a very different style. So Paul the aged was very effective in his older years. And we'll see that later, in a little bit later, with John, John the Apostle. We see Paul the aged, as he calls himself, being very effective in his calling when he was older. Let's look at another person, Joshua. Let's go back to the Old Testament, Joshua. Joshua, we see in Joshua 24, verse 29, was 110 years when he died. So if you want to turn there, we'll be in Joshua for a few minutes. Joshua 24, verse 29, we see 110 years old when he died. Now, how old was Joshua when he began to lead Israel into the promised land? Remember, Moses couldn't go in, and he passed on the leadership role. God did really pass on the leadership role to Joshua. Well, there's just some different thoughts on this. But he wasn't young. He was not young when he took on the role of leading Israel into the promised land and to start subduing Canaan. He could have been as old as 85 years when he began to lead Israel and to lead Israel into the promised land. Now let's turn back a few scriptures. Joshua 13:1. Joshua 13:1. Joshua 13:1. And it says, now Joshua was old, advanced in years. And the Lord said to him, you're old, advanced in years. I always think that's kind of funny. Joshua's old, and God says, you're old, advanced in years. And there remains very much land yet to be possessed. So Joshua was old, and he had still a lot to do. How about God telling you, hey, you may be in your 80s, and you're old, but there's still a lot to do. Get going. Well, Joshua heard that and he did it. Let's look at the end of Joshua's life when he was giving some final words to the Israelites. This is found in the book of Joshua, the 24th book of Joshua, where I referenced earlier, the 24th book of the book of Joshua. And he's still going strong in what? Maybe not in how he feels physically, as you'll see, but he's still going strong in his commitment to God to the end of his age, and he has a message for the Israelites. Joshua 24, verse 14. And this has got to be very close to the end of his life when he died at 110. Joshua 24, verse 14. He says, now therefore, he's telling the Israelites, now therefore, fear the Lord, serve him in sincerity and in truth, and put away the gods which your fathers served on the other side of the river and in Egypt. Serve the Lord. And that's very emphatic. And if it seems evil to you to serve the Lord, choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served that were on the other side of the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell. But here's what he says, right? It's very famous. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Still serving God with great conviction. Serve in sincerity and truth. Sounds a lot like what Jesus told the Samaritan woman. He says, worship the Father, or true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. Joshua's conviction to God is still being demonstrated. Joshua 24, verse 29. Now it came to pass after these things that Joshua, son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died, being 110 years old, and they buried him within the borders of his inheritance at Timnath-Serah, which is in the mountains of Ephraim, on the north side of Mount Gash. And interesting, verse 31, Israel served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had known all the works of the Lord which he had done for Israel. So Joshua was used by God mightily when he was older in age, and the elders who were with him that outlived him had that same conviction. Interesting to note that when that generation died off, was no longer around, Israel floundered and went backwards in their commitment to God. It went backwards. So in terms of Joshua's in training, let's think about that for a moment. Many say King Charles III, Prince Charles, King Charles III, had a very long apprenticeship to be king. 73 years, I think is what I saw, 73 years before he became king. Longest apprenticeship, that's what they're saying. But Joshua, in his own way, had a very long apprenticeship working under Moses before being the leader of Israel. And they subdued the land of Canaan. Possibly Joshua worked with Moses longer than King Charles was prince. You know, think about that. He might have been doing it a lot longer than Prince Charles, now King Charles III. Joshua was a very effective leader in his later years and was used by God mightily to lead Israel into the promised land. Let's look at another older servant who was used mightily at the end of his life. Let's look at Daniel. Daniel. Now, Daniel was probably around 17 years of age when he was deported by Nebuchadnezzar to Babylon. And he was of noble birth, meaning he would have had the education, the protocols, and other training that would have been valuable in the courts of Nebuchadnezzar. Many years passed, and there's a lot there, but Daniel outlives Nebuchadnezzar and other Babylonian rulers who came after Nebuchadnezzar. And then he's still living, and he's being valued by the next dynasty, the next kingdom, you might say, that came on the scene, the Medo-Persian Empire. And let's see this. So Daniel 6:1, let's turn there, Daniel 6:1. And we see Daniel now maybe as old as 90 years of age, 90 years of age. Well, how do we know that? I could have given you some numbers to help you figure out how old Joshua was, but let's look at Daniel. We'll do that. Well, 605 BC was the first deportation that Nebuchadnezzar did. He went in there, and there's three. The first one was around 605. And their approach to Babylonians, what they did, they didn't really want to conquer and destroy every city that they took over. They wanted the people that they conquered to stay in place and be to flourish and to do well and be prosperous and pay taxes, more or less. That's what they wanted. So their goal wasn't to destroy Jerusalem. So in 605 was the first time he came down, Nebuchadnezzar, and he took some people away. And that's where Daniel was taken away. Now, why did they do that? This is a little extra history lesson. Well, part of it was he might have, you know, he took the brightest and most educated, which was typically from the noble families, which Daniel was. But also, just think about it. If people take your family away, your kids, your sons and daughters, and they take them away to Babylon, there's a little bit of like, you'd probably think about twice before you like decide to rebel. That's part of the reason too why they did that. Although the Israelites didn't seem to worry about that. Somehow they kept on like rebelling. So at 605, there was the first deportation. So that's where Daniel was. And think about him being about 17 at the time. Now, what's the other number we can kind of look at? Well, 539 was when Babylon fell and the Medo-Persians came in. And then this is what we're going to pick up the story at. So we have 66 years there plus 17 for how old he was. So you get to Daniel. So you got to add Daniel at least at 83. He's at least 83 years old. And some say older. So let's look at Daniel at this point in his life. He's at least 83 years of age and maybe even older. Daniel 6:1. So again, he's outlived the Babylonian kings, Nebuchadnezzar and his sons and others. And now he's kind of moving on to the next empire, which has Cyrus. And Darius was his uncle. Sometimes people don't quite understand, who's Darius, who's Cyrus? Well, Cyrus kept on, he was really the ruler, but he put his uncle Darius, who was a Mede, and because of Mede Persians, they kind of worked together. Anyway, he put Darius in charge. Cyrus took off. We'll hear about, we won't cover Cyrus today, but he's in the mix too. But this is all Daniel 6:1, at least 83 years later from when Daniel first got deported in 605. So in Daniel 6:1, it pleased Darius to appoint 120 satraps to rule throughout the kingdom with three administrators over them, one of whom was Daniel. So he's like one of the three top guys. The satraps were made accountable to them so that the king might not suffer loss. Now, Daniel, verse 3, so distinguished himself among the administrators and the satraps by his exceptional qualities that the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. So he's going to be the second in charge next to the king. At this point, the administrators, as you can imagine, didn't like that idea, and the satraps tried to find grounds for charges against Daniel in his conduct of government affairs. But they were unable to do so. They could find no corruption in him because he was trustworthy and neither corrupt nor negligent. Finally, these men said, "We will never find any basis for charges against this man, Daniel, unless it has something to do with the law of his God." But notice how Daniel's described, trustworthy, neither corrupt nor negligent. He was going to be set of the whole kingdom. That's how good he was. And we know the story of what happened. Darius was tricked into putting something in motion, a law in motion. So Daniel would have to be thrown into the lion's den. And Darius, of course, was very sorrowful, but because of the way the laws worked, he couldn't change it. He couldn't change the decision. But Daniel's not hurt by the lions. And then Daniel is therefore honored by Darius. Let's look at that in verse 28. I won't go through the whole story. Let's drop down verse 28, where Daniel's is not hurt by the lions. Daniel 6, verse 28, then Darius wrote to all the nations and peoples of every language in all the earth, and it says, "May your prosperity." Imagine this going out from the President of the United States or somebody like that going out to all everybody in the land. But that's what's going on. "May you prosper greatly. I issue a decree that in every part of my kingdom, people must fear and reverence the God of Daniel, for he is the living God, and he endures forever. His kingdom will not be destroyed. His dominion will never end. He rescues and he saves. He performs signs and wonders in the heavens and on the earth. He has rescued Daniel from the power of the lions, So Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian. So Daniel was a very faithful servant to the end. And he was very, very effective in his older years. He never stopped being effective. He kept on going. In fact, at his later years, he was used by Darius, you know, the most powerful kingdom at the time. And he was really the second in charge, a lot like Joseph in Egypt in many ways, very similar. So Daniel was a faithful servant to the end and was very effective in his older years. So while we're in Daniel, let's look at something interesting, I think, that you might find interesting, at least for some of you here, just looking around, looking at your hair. Let's look at the Ancient of Days. We see a vision that God, who we understand to be God the Father, called the Ancient of Days, and in Daniel 7:9, there's a very interesting description, Daniel 7:9. And here we see Daniel's given a vision of really what we understand to be the Father, who became the Father, the God Father, Father in heaven. And it says in verse 9, I watched till thrones were put in place, and the Ancient of Days was seated. And his garments was white as snow, and the hair of his head was like pure wool. His throne was a fiery flame, his wheels a burning fire. A fiery stream issued and came forth from before him. 1,000 thousands ministered to him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court was seated and the books were open. But Daniel 7:9 says that this person we understand to be God the Father had hair like pure wool. The vision of the one called the Ancient of Days and is represented as having hair like pure wool. So for those that are older and grayer or silver haired, let me connect this to Proverbs 16:31. You don't have to turn there, but I'll read it to you. Proverbs 16:31, the silver haired head is a crown of glory. I believe that's NIV version. If it is found in the way of righteousness, the silver haired head is a crown of glory. It is found in the way of righteousness. If it is found in the way of righteousness. Young's literal translation says this, a crown of beauty are their gray hairs. In the way of righteousness, it is found. So if you're gray haired, more like who's not gray haired almost in this audience, but if you're gray or silver haired, it is a crown of glory, especially if you're righteous, which I hope all of us are in that category, and it appears based on what we read in Daniel. God the Father, the Ancient of Days, was shown to Daniel with something similar. You know, he had hair like wool, so wool's white. So a lot of us in there have white hair. So just something to note, something interesting to see. All right, let's keep on moving on. Zacharias and Elizabeth. Let's turn there to Zacharias and Elizabeth, the parents of John the Baptist. So Luke 1 and verse 5. There was in the days of Herod, the king of Judea, a certain priest named Zacharias of the division of Abijah. His wife was of the daughters of Aaron, and her name was Elizabeth. And they were both righteous before God, walking in all the commandments and ordinances of the Lord blameless. For verse 7, but they had no child because Elizabeth was barren. And they were very well advanced in age. The NIV says very old. It's very old. So Zacharias was serving as a priest, and we understand this was around Pentecost. His priestly corps or division was serving, and he was still serving at an older age. Now, David did put some restrictions in on the priest serving, and at 50, that was the age that they could sort of retire from doing the physical work. Because, you know, if you're a priest and they're bringing animals, and how many people have maybe killed a large animal and then had to skin it and break it out, you know, deer hunters or people that have sheep. It's quite a lot of work. So imagine doing that every day, day after day. It's not something that someone older would like to do at some point because of how physical it is. And that's what they're responsible for in many ways. Possibly Zacharias, based on the type of service he was doing, could have been older. So we don't really know, but he's called an old person, older person. All right, let's turn to Zechariah. Let's keep going to Luke 1, verse 18. And we see, we know the story. Zacharias went in to perform his duties. He got the opportunity. And my understanding was that the duty they were doing was only done once by a priest. And he had not done it up to this point. And he was chosen. And he's in there doing this, we believe, on or around my memory serves me right, around on Pentecost, possibly. And Zacharias said to the angel, so an angel came and said, and he questions this, you know, he says, he's going to have a child. And Zacharias said to the angel, how shall I know this? This is why he's in the temple. No one else is around. And for I am an old man, and my wife is well advanced in years. And the angel answered and said to him, I am Gabriel, who stands in the presence of God and was sent to speak to you and bring you these glad tidings. So God used Zacharias and Elizabeth, and they were much older. And, you know, they were, you know, what did it say about them? That they were older, but they were righteous before God, walking in all commandments and ordinances and of the Lord blameless. So they were doing everything they're supposed to do. Now, this has nothing to do with the topic, but it's just a side note. You can kind of think about this yourself, just contemplate it. So as a side note, just interesting, there is a possible lesson on how God, through Gabriel, dealt with Zacharias when he sort of questioned Gabriel, how can this be so? Remember, he wasn't able to speak. Well, just a few verses over, I think it's verse 32. Well, Gabriel is sent to Mary and says, you're done to have a son. She kind of says, well, how can that be? I've never known a man. And if you notice that this is going to be a study, it has nothing to do really what I'm trying to cover today, but just an interesting thought to leave you with. It's interesting how God dealt with Zacharias, who maybe should have been a little more, I think God expected more of him, let's put it that way, as an older priest, man, individual, and Gabriel was sent to him and told him something, and he couldn't have questioned it, and he lost his voice. Now, Mary, you read what he says back to Mary, very gentle and sensitive, right? Two different individuals. And there's a little bit of a lesson there that God does expect, based on who you are, where you are, and what you know, I think God deals with people differently. And Mary was you could read that, it's very, very gentle. When she sort of says, well, how can this be so? But Zacharias sort of said, oh, you're an angel, and God says it, yes, sir, it's going to happen, right? And it's interesting to know that Gabriel, just so you know, that Gabriel in the hierarchy, Gabriel is our, this is another little piece of information, just kind of keeping the back of your mind. If you look in the Bible, what is Gabriel used for? Well, we should know. Sending, whenever there's a message to be sent, who does God use? Gabriel. Now, who is the other archangel that we are aware of? Not Lucifer, of course, but the other one that God uses that we know of. Michael, right? Well, what is Michael used for? Battle. There's battles. Guess who's there? Michael. So it's just interesting to think about that. You know, God has all these angels, his archangels, cherubs, seraphims, angels, and they all have a purpose. And it's interesting that Gabriel is always used to send a message. At least that's what we see in the Bible. And Michael's used when there's war, battle. So different purposes. I guess the only thing I can say from that is if Gabriel sends you, comes to you and gives you a message, don't question it. Just say it's going to happen. Of course, I don't think that will happen to any of us, but you never know. But there's a lesson in there. I thought it was an interesting side lesson just to see how God dealt with Zacharias when he kind of questioned it and how he dealt with Mary. Very different situation. But Saint Gabriel came to both of them. All right, let's go back to really the main thrust of the message today. God looked down on Zacharias and Elizabeth in their old age, And they were called both righteous before God, walking in all commandments and ordinances of the Lord, blameless. Very good example. Very good example. All right, let's look at another one. Anna the prophetess. Prophetess. It's hard to say for me. Anna the prophetess. All right, Luke 2:36. A couple of pages over, if you're in Luke still. Luke 2:36. Now there was one Anna, a prophetess, a daughter of Phanuel of the tribe of Asher. She was of great age and had lived with a husband 7 years from her virginity. And this woman was a widow of about 84 years, who did not depart from the temple, but served God with fastings and prayers night and day. And coming in that instant, she gave thanks to the Lord and spoke of him to all those who looked for redemption in Jerusalem. So we see Anna described as being one who did not depart from the temple, but served God with fastings and prayers day and night. So it's not clear how old she is exactly, but she's up there in age. We know that she's older than 84 years old, if we understand how this is written correctly. And she served God with fastings and prayers. And prayers of widows can be quite powerful, very powerful. You know, if you're, prayers of all the widows can be quite powerful. When some of you, and this happens with some of you, and I say people, because this does apply to people here, who are older widows, tell me that you're praying for something, or even for me, that is something not to be taken lightly. Widows have said, they told me, they prayed for a certain message, and that when I gave it that day, they're like, oh, God answered my prayers. I mean, and maybe, widows, prayers of widows and older widows are very powerful. And in, there's scriptures I can show you that God listens to the prayers, his ears specifically tuned to older widows and olders. I mean, and here we see Anna, who served God in that very way by praying and fasting. People, and that's how Anna served God, and that's what she did. Very powerful. When a widow says they're praying for you, that's a very good feeling. Because you know that God is hearing those prayers. All right, let's go on to John the Apostle, the Apostle John. Now, John wrote when he was 80 or 90 years old. I mentioned some of that last week. The Gospel of John, 1st, 2nd, 3rd John, and he certainly wrote, in a sense, he recorded Revelation. And I think it's quite significant that John wrote not when he was 30 years old or 40 years old or 60 years old or 70 years old, but at least 50 years after being an apostle. Now, John is thought to have been the youngest apostle, the youngest original apostle. And God didn't have him write epistles, at least the ones that we have in our Bible, I should say, and the gospel that we have, or record Revelation, until he was 80 or 90 years of age, in that age range. So just think about that. What was the nickname that Jesus gave James and John, the brothers, the sons of Zebedee? The sons of thunder, right? The sons of thunder. That's the name he gave them. Because what do they want to do? This is the thought anyway, that they came to Jesus and said, oh, these towns don't do what we say. Let's bring down some fire on them. And he corrected them. He goes, and that's not the right mindset, and that's where the thought is where the name came, Sons of Thunder, because that's the way that was their mindset. They were fired up, ready to cast down fire on a city and burn it up because they were a little bit disrespected. And Christ said that's not the way it works. But he wrote about the death. Think about this. He wrote about the death of God's love in his later age. Now, I've noticed, I kind of made this reference before, but I've noticed that much older ministers, those who are maybe in their late 70s or 80s, or in their 70s and 80s that still speak, they tend to have an approach that brings out the love and mercy of God in their messages. This seems to come out more. It doesn't mean others don't do it, but it just seems that when they speak, that the love and the mercy that of God comes out when they speak. The older ministers, I've noticed that. And I think that's something we should consider. John certainly isn't the son of thunder at the end of his age, right? At the end of his life. But he's the apostle of love in his later age. Many of God's servants were used in their most dramatic and effective ways toward the end of their life, their physical life, not when they were younger. I'm sure there's some exceptions, for sure, and maybe there are. But many times you see that even though God used them maybe starting at a very young age, they became the most effective and most powerful ways when they were older. And that's with age, along with God's Spirit together. You know, I think when you just grow, you can have a lot of God's Spirit when you're younger, but the aging process certainly adds to that together to really have a mature way of looking at things. Now, let's look at how are older members of high value in the church? So we talked about some principles, but let's talk about how they're of high value in the church. Now, through the examples we just covered, you see that those that are older can be quite effective in many ways. In examples of diligence, faithfulness, wisdom, communication, and prayers and fastings even. But let's look specifically how they can add maturity and soundness to a healthy church. Titus 2. Let's go to Titus 2. Titus 2. This is one of my favorite sections to go to. I come back from an organizational development of organizations and how to put things together for organizations and how organizations run to some degree. And I always find Titus 2 very interesting from that perspective. Because really, Titus 2 is Paul telling Titus, how does a sound, healthy church run? You know, and this, how does it look? Why does it look that way? And why does it work that way? If you have a sound church, why do you have one? So in Titus 2, verse 1, he says, but for you speak the things which are proper for sound doctrine. And that's where he starts, sound doctrine. And this is talking to Titus. And the key here, and I'll start here because I think it's a good place to start to understand the next context, which is really about the older men and older women, but proper for sound doctrine. And here's what's very important to understand for anybody responsible for doctrine. And I'm still talking to myself here, but anybody who speaks, really. But key is sound and healthy doctrine is being taught. So if you look at a healthy church that's running right, and every church, you know, just like back in the days of New Testament, you had different churches. And yet the Corinthians, and they had some problems. They weren't necessarily a sound, healthy church. They had constant divisions and problems and going on, and there was challenges there. And Paul had to fix that. And then you had other churches that were known to be more sound. And we had that today. If you go across any landscape of the churches, you know, every congregation has its own sort of personality and approach, and you might even say spiritual maturity. And one thing to look at first and foremost is sound doctrine, healthy doctrine being preached every Sabbath, week after week. We have the legacy of sound doctrine being taught over the years, decades in this area. Right? No one would dispute that, I don't think. And I liken healthy doctrine, because sound means healthy. You look at the word sound, healthy, to healthy eating. If we eat well, if we all eat well every day, we're going to be healthy, right? If you have, all the things you should be eating, your greens, your salads, and your vegetables, and your fruits, and some healthy meat, and proteins, and some good potatoes, and whatever, you're going to be healthy. And that's the same as the church. So if you're hearing, if a church is hearing sound doctrine, it's going to filter in, and over decades of the church existing, you're going to have a healthy, sound church. This is the way it works. Now, if you have what I call pizza sermons, now, who would give their kids pizza every night? Hope nobody raises their hand. You know, you can make healthy pizza, I guess. But, you know, pizza, or something to that effect. If you give your kids pizza every day, I mean, I like pizza. Who doesn't like pizza? But if my mom gave me pizza every single day of my life, you know, it would be problems, right? I'd probably not, I would, who knows what health problems I'd have. Because you just can't eat it. Now, everybody likes a pizza every so often. That's good. But if you have, it's all you have. And that's the same thing as doctrine. If you constantly have pizza, doctrinal pizza meals, you might say, you're done to have a church that reflects it. Just this is the way it works. Any long-time experienced pastor who knows that will tell you that. So one of the things that a pastor has to do, and I saw, you know, I've seen it, you know, every, we're all friends here, you know, Mr. Fay and Mr. Roansby's and Mr. D'Alessandro. I mean, if you don't give good, solid sermons week after week, you're going to have a congregation that starts to get spiritual colds and flus. Just the way it is over time. So it's really important they have sound doctrine. Thankfully, we can be thankful that God in the areas here, Beloit, including Chicago and Munster, have had people that have heard, congregations have heard, had healthy meals week after week. And the congregation tends to reflect that. Because, you know, the way it really works, in my opinion, or my thought, my observation, what I've seen my whole life through my dad and Mr. Fay and others, is, you know, you get to a point where you realize if everybody in the congregation has God's Spirit, which is the assumption, everybody's got God's Spirit, and you're giving healthy, sound doctrine from the pulpit, and you put a lot of time into your messages, and that comes out, God will give you what you need to hear through the message, right? And you self-correct. You over time, you see people, the best way, and we all can acknowledge that, what's the best way to kind of, oh, I should be doing this versus that, or I should think about that. It's not someone coming and tell you, hey, you got a problem, you know, sort of hits you, well, hopefully it doesn't hit you upside the head. That's the old school way, but, you know, it does something, kind of gives you a bit of a nudge. Hey, get on track. I mean, you can do that, but it may not work out very well. But the best way is when you hear sound, healthy doctrine from being taught, and God through His Spirit working in you, you hear what you need to hear. I hear what I need to hear. You're like, yeah, I probably should make a change here. That's the best way, and that's what a healthy church looks like after 25, 30 years of hearing, or a church that has a lot of sound doctrine being. And if you have other things going on in the congregation that aren't so great, sometimes it's good to look at, well, what are they hearing every week? Anyway, that's just let's go back to that. But it starts with sound doctrine. Now let's look at what comes next. That the older men are to be sober, reverent, temperate, sound in faith, in love, in patience. So this describes, again, my Bible has qualities of a sound church, qualities of a healthy church. And you have sound doctrine being taught. And then you have older men that are what? Really mature. They're sober, which means related, you know, it certainly means they're not being intoxicated and drinking beer and wine. But it really refers to their whole demeanor. They're serious minded. They're vigilant. You know, they're not, you know, foolish jokesters going around and being silly, right? I mean, how would it be like if I came into this church area and some of the older men here started being foolish jokesters with me, I'd be kind of like, what's going on, right? That's not how older men are, right? We're kind of, they're serious. And it doesn't mean they can't enjoy a good laugh. Doesn't mean they can't enjoy a good joke, but it refers to an older man being vigilant. What else does it say? Reverent means they're honorable. They're dignified. Temperate means there's self-control. Safe in the mind, or kind of having, you know, that's what it kind of means, temperate means. Sound in faith, you know, they're not going to have, you know, they're not able to, they're healthy in their faith. They're not a corrupt faith. They're sound. They know what they believe, and they trust in God, and they rely on God, and they're not double-minded. In love, you know, like I said, sometimes the older men that are speaking, they tend to bring out God's love. And I think there's a reason for that. And it says older men in love. They have a sense of understanding God's mercy and kindness and love in their own lives. And it's very, it can be very helpful for a younger person to talk to an older man who, you know, maybe you've made a mistake or younger and you kind of, and the older men tend to be much more, you know, they can be firm, but understanding and show love in the situation. And impatience, it says, impatience. Endurance and steadfastness. I mean, they have patience. They've been enduring, steadfastness, and patiently waiting. That's what that means, the word patience there. So these describe mature spiritually men that are in the congregation. And if you have this in a congregation, which you have a lot of it here, you know, it's just a wonderful blessing that you have older men in a congregation. God doesn't just call everybody. You know, you look at a really healthy congregation, you know, he doesn't call everybody. A really good congregation doesn't have all 20-year-olds. Imagine that. Or 30-year-olds. They're all teenagers. That would be a really hard church to manage, I would think. But you have older men, you have older women, and then you have, and it says younger men and younger women, which we won't go into all that. But the older men really play a solid part because they have these qualities. Reverent, temperate, sound in faith, in love, and in patience. That's how they are. Now, verse 3, we're getting onto the older women. The older women likewise, that they be reverent in behavior, not slanderers, not given to much wine, teachers of good things, that they admonish the young woman to love their husbands. So let's talk about, first of all, the reverent in behavior. So this is character that reflects a demeanor that is considered sacred by God. They've got a reverent in behavior. They're very reverent in how they behave and how they operate and how they go through their life. They're not slanderers. It doesn't mean they accuse something falsely. It's not a lot of gossip. They're not unjustly criticizing to hurt. So it's not given to much wine. You know, they're not enslaved or addicted to wine. They're not out there, you know, drinking, you know, a bottle of wine every day. And they're not, you know, again, it doesn't say wine's bad, just that they're not living their life around wine as a constant way of life. Teachers of good things. You know, teachers of good things. Teachers of what is good. Teachers of excellence is another way of saying it, is one translation. Teach what is proper. Examples of goodness is another way that is stated. Teach what is right. And what that's what they do. They teach, are teachers of good things. So what is the purpose? What's one of the benefits? Well, they admonish the young women to love their husbands, to love their children, to be discreet, chaste, homemakers, good, obedient to their own husbands, that the word of God may be blasphemed. So this is the role of older women, how they really help the church. When they do these things, they set the example, and they can help teach when appropriate those that are younger. And I've seen this in action. It's so nice when you have older women and you have younger women who are maybe new to to motherhood or new to other things, and you have an older lady who just sort of puts their arm around them in a nice way, not telling them, you know, how to do everything, but just gives them, you know, some help and guidance. Here's how it goes, and here's what you can do here. And I know that young women, when it's done that way, really appreciate that help. The older women and men are key members in having a healthy or sound church. Older members are highly valued in the congregation. For those here, and that's most of everybody, but a few, thank you for your service and dedication and your examples. Very, very much appreciated for all those that are older. You know, appreciate the example and service. And you, what I just read about the older men and women, I see it all the time here. I see it every week when I come, or every time I come here. So let me provide you some final words of encouragement. I know many of you have daily struggles that come with old age. Bodies that just don't work the way they used to. Getting up out of bed every day and everything like that that comes with it is a struggle, can be a struggle. And I'm reminded of Proverbs 20, verse 29. The glory of young men, and you could say young women as well, is their strength. And the splendor of old men is their gray head. So the glory that was in the strength of a young man is now, for many, a long time ago. And many are in the age of splendor of honor that is shown by gray hair. But there is some additional encouragement I want to leave you. And we find that in Isaiah 40, verse 28. If you want to turn there, Isaiah 40, verse 28. Isaiah 40, verse 28. And Isaiah writes, and I think hopefully this thing is encouraging to you. It's meant to be. And it's written to be encouraging for those that, especially I think, that are older and getting up every day, doing your normal things, it's just not that easy anymore. Life is a little challenging when it comes to the physical aspects of life. Isaiah 40 verse 28 says, "Do you not know? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He will not grow tired or weary, and his understanding no one can fathom. He gives strength to the weary and increases the power of the weak. Even youths grow tired and weary, and young men stumble and fall. But those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength. They will soar on wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary, and they will walk and not be faint." So, sir, keep hoping in the Lord and having your strength renewed in the Lord. Continue to spiritually run and walk and soar on wings like eagles.